So the podcast idea that came about with in our College of Fine Arts, and Cynthia, you've been here before. So on the 8th floor of this big old building is our university radio station, public radio station and TV. And the station director asked me as a new faculty member if I had any ideas for new content that might be interesting for our area. So I said, well, maybe. And so we've been working on this idea for this podcast. And I'm so grateful for both of you to sit down and sort of pick your brain and ask some questions. And when we're done with all of this, I'll sort of distill it down and add some music, the composers that we may talk about or other things, and send it to you so you can look it over and make sure that, you know, I didn't record anyone sneezing or you're happy with the way that things sound before, of course, we do anything else with it. So I appreciate your time.
Of course, yeah. I'm honored to be here.
Well, I thought we'd start maybe before we jump too far in. I imagine that some of our listeners will be bandos like us in many cases, or folks with a musical background. But we also know that many of the listeners here in our region are listening just to public radio and may not know a whole lot about band. So before we get started, how about Courtney, would you like to go first? Could you give us maybe like a 1 to 2 minute intro of who you are and how you've come to be where you currently are?
Sure.
Super.
My name is Courtney Snyder. I'm the Associate Director of Bands and Associate Professor of Conducting at the University of Michigan. And this is my 5th year in that position. Prior to that, I taught at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, which is it's part of the Nebraska system. And I taught there for 5 years. I was Assistant Director of Bands. I grew up from Pennsylvania and just kind of fell in love with music in general through high school and decided I wanted to do music ed. And through the course of my studies, just realized that although I would teach in the public schools, I really wanted to find my home at the university level and just continue to pursue my degrees through that process to reach that goal. And that's why I am where I am now.
That's excellent. And Cynthia, could you tell us a little about yourself as well?
Cool. Yep. My name is Cynthia Johnson Turner. I am currently the director of bands at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. Go Dogs. And I've been in the position 5 years now. It's my 5th year. I'm also artistic director of Rotohund Musik, which is a contemporary chamber ensemble populated by graduate students, which is a pre-professional model of contemporary music. Before that, I was 10 years at Cornell University as director of wind ensembles. And before that, I was teaching, was head of music at a high school just outside of Toronto, Ontario, which I loved doing. And Courtney was saying that she wanted to pursue university music. I never actually wanted to do that. I loved teaching high school music. I just love that age group and love that, I don't know, I love how much they need you at high school and middle school. And just a series of events led me to pursue a master's, and then that was it. Then I was hungry and wanted to pursue a doctorate, and that's when things started to change for me. So I thought I was going to stay teaching high school music for the rest of my career because I loved it, but then some doors opened, and here I am.
That's great. That's really wonderful. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing how both of your backgrounds and experience sort of add to some of these questions. And you should know, yesterday I had the opportunity to speak with Andrea Brown from University of Maryland, and we had a really great conversation and many number of other things. And so I know that she was previously at Michigan, and it was just a lot of fun to sit down and visit with her as well. So thanks to you both as well. The first question I pose to everyone is this sort of intro question to band, really. Do you think that band conductors from the early 20th century would recognize our ensembles today? And is that a good or bad thing? And I think we started with Courtney last. Perhaps, Cynthia, you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I often talk about a clinic I went to once with a couple of people from Apple who talked about, imagine plucking somebody from the early 20th century and whatever they were doing in a time machine and plunking them down in the middle of Times Square today. And imagining that person's experience, and they would be completely blown away by, you know, the noise level and the lights and the, and what people were wearing and the cars and the smells, and just everything would be extraordinary for them until they walked into a classroom, and then they would know exactly where they were. So not much has really changed in education in really, if you think about it. And I think the same thing would happen if you plucked somebody up from the Sousa band or an early 20th century band and plunked them down into a wind ensemble rehearsal today. I mean, they would probably know exactly where to sit. They might wonder why there were so many percussion instruments in the room, but basically, you know, everything would look the same, especially, you know, the person who's standing on a box holding a stick, telling them what to do, when to do, and how to do it. So in that way, I don't think we look that much different. We might be a little bit more diverse. There might be a few more women in the ensemble. There might even be a woman on the box. But generally speaking, how we look is pretty much how we've always looked. There's a deeper level to this question I know you're getting to, but I essentially don't think that we look that much different. We're even wearing the same clothes. I mean, not exactly the same clothes, but we look, right. You know, we look pretty much the same.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I would
add, though, repertoire
sure.
speaking, you know, I would say that the wind ensemble, generally speaking, is a little bit more adventuresome than orchestra in terms of what we program and how we program it. The fact that we keep commissioning composers to write new works for us is a wonderful thing. And so we've been a little, you know, we've been called the friend of the living composer, and I think that that's a wonderful thing, except we're not necessarily reprogramming the works that we've commissioned over the last 30, 40 years that we deem as high quality, and therefore it's difficult for us to develop the kind of core canon or repertoire that the orchestra has over the years.
Sure. Courtney, any thoughts on all that?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree in the fact that the process through which, like in a rehearsal and whatnot, I don't think any of that really has changed, other than perhaps the method through which we talk to each other, maybe the demeanor of the said conductor or whatnot, just in terms of how we communicate. I think that certainly would be different just because our culture is so different today.
Yeah.
But that still wouldn't be that far away from, I think, somebody coming in from that time period. Just kind of, they would know what's going on. I do think that certainly the repertoire concept would be different, although there are certainly pieces that we would program that perhaps somebody at that time would know. I think there's just a lot more flexibility now. We don't necessarily have, I mean, after kind of Frederick Fidel and Eastman with the whole wind ensemble concept of having a lot more flexibility with instrumentation and changing the size of the ensemble, I think that would be different than somebody from the very early 20th century.
Yeah.
Although, you know, Stravinsky is certainly writing pieces, you know, in that canon and Berez. I mean, there are certainly chamber pieces there, but I don't think they would have been programmed on a regular band concert.
Certainly.
At mm-hmm. that time.
Yeah, it was interesting.
And now I think that's more standard at certainly with concerts in general.
Certainly, yeah. One of the conversations that came up yesterday, I mentioned speaking with Andrea, that she was talking about that many of the works that she plays tend to fall more in that standard repertoire as this conductor of a second group at a university, whereas Mike Voda programs more these sort of what you're talking about now, sort of large chamber ensemble pieces that still require a conductor but are certainly borderline of would someone from the Sousa band have any idea what this piece was, what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As we're talking about repertoire, and Courtney, maybe we'll jump to you this time. The second question, and this is, it seems obvious, but I think to some of our lay listeners, they may not understand the significance of repertoire, particularly in our ensembles associated with universities. So the second question is, how important is selecting meaningful repertoire? I wonder if you want to dabble on that first.
Well, I would hope that everything I'm doing is meaningful. I mean, I think that's really essential. I wouldn't, so maybe I'm getting hung up on the word meaningful. I'm thinking, is meaningful like quality?
I guess even rather, meaningful for us aside, maybe the question is better posed as how important is selecting repertoire for your ensembles that you conduct?
I mean, it's essential. That's really the repertoire is the curriculum for my ensemble. And I look at my ensemble, for one, I have a curricular mindset of thinking about what do I want my students to experience over the course of the time that they're in the university,
sure.
which can vary depending on like what degree they're getting and such, and also, you know, how long they're in my ensemble. But I'm also thinking of it from what are pieces that I think are valuable to the repertoire and to the canon as a whole. So, I mean, I spend a tremendous amount of time programming. For one, I would love to just program everything I wanted, but I also have to think about how does this piece fit with my group? How does it fit within the entire concert that I'm programming? Even as I'm thinking about the entire semester or the entire year, I mean, I don't want to be doing a bunch of things that are too repetitive. I want to be giving them varied experiences. I also have other, I have grad students and whatnot to consider for what pieces they might be conducting within my ensemble,
sure.
For their own curricular needs, as well as some of the other faculty. Sometimes we have, there's 4 band faculty at Michigan, so usually we try to give an experience to the athletic band directors as well, to at least get an opportunity in front of music major ensembles. So those are all elements that I have to consider when I'm putting in the programming. But the absolute most important thing is that I'm putting in repertoire that I think has value and is important to be played.
Certainly. And Cynthia, you at the beginning when I posed the question, you were ready to jump right in. Please, please, by all means, tell us.
Well, no, I mean, I absolutely agree with everything Courtney has said. And, you know, we do, I think it's probably the thing that I spend the most time on is developing an artistically meaningful or important or quality program. And there are a variety of stakeholders involved in that. Of course, the students, but also the other conductors, the grad conductors, the audience. I think we have to think about our relevant. I care deeply about the audience. I know some conductors don't. In a pedagogical situation, that's apparently not something we need to worry about, but I beg to differ on that. And also my own needs. You know, I have to think about what, if I'm not completely in love with, turned on, intrigued by a piece of music, I'm not going to be the best conductor or teacher I can be with it. And the other thing I would add to Courtney's beautifully said statement is that I'm now increasingly compelled to program music that has a social justice meaning or is meaningful in a way, if we're going to use that word, to help the students, myself, our audience, process some of the things that are going on in our world through art. It's just become something I can't not do.
Right.
You know, it's not something I have to do on every concert, but it's something I think that our students desperately need to do. And our audiences are looking for ways to process some of the things that are going on. So finding quality music that addresses some social issues to me is becoming increasingly important. I don't think this is any more something that we can do. I think it's something, at least for me, that we should do.
Yeah. And both of you are situated at a very large schools with multiple bands and ensembles. Can you talk a little bit about the as we talk about selecting repertoire, the vertical alignment of those groups? I mean, I think, Courtney, you touched on the idea of making sure that some of the conductors, the athletic band conductor gets in front of a music major ensemble. How does that process of collaboration come together to sort of look at repertoire from the top to the bottom?
Sorry. Were you asking me?
I'm looking forward to hear from both of you because I know that there are there are several bands of music majors at Michigan plus non-major ensembles in Georgia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ahead, we have, at Michigan, we have 2 music major bands.
Okay.
The remainder of the bands within the program are actually comprised of non-majors or perhaps majors on secondary instruments.
Sure.
So my Cave Cox is director of bands. He conducts the symphony band, and then I conduct the concert band. So he, as director of bands, and Cindy could speak to this because she's director of bands at Georgia, but he kind of has a system in place in terms of making sure that we're at least sharing some of those responsibilities and making sure that because we have two other band directors who don't get opportunities in front of, like, their ensemble is not comprised of music majors, that it's important for them to have that experience as well.
Sure.
So that's perhaps more unique than other places, but it's just the nature of how our ensembles are organized at Michigan. And both of our ensembles are pretty large. So my group is 65 to 70, like two students, generally speaking, and Mike's is just a little bit bigger than that. So we encompass quite a few students.
Right.
So that's also why perhaps it's a little different. And a lot of our students do not double in orchestra and band. So we're really spreading all the winds, brass, and percussion students amongst four ensembles because there's two orchestras for them to play in. So that's why it's organized that way. And that's why they usually with symphony band, unlike maybe a chamber winds concert or whatnot, and with concert band, we just try to make sure that they get an opportunity with each of those ensembles within a semester throughout the year.
Got it.
Yeah, our situation.
Cindy, go ahead.
Yeah, it's similar and different, and similar in some ways and different in others. So the Hodgson Wind Ensemble, which is the top group that I do, is flexible instrumentation, and would rarely have 60 to 70 students in it. So it's more of a one on a part chamber ensemble. We have a few more. We have up to six trumpets, and we have some extra clarinets in there. But basically, it's the Eastman model with one on a part, and then Jackie Hartenberger, who does the Wind Symphony at Georgia, which is the so-called second band, also uses that model. And that way, we have a trickle-down effect that we have actually three ensembles that are either all music majors or at least have some music majors in it. So the top three bands. So the third band is done by the director of athletic bands, Mike Robinson, and his associate director of athletic bands, Brett Bauckham, do the symphonic band. So that's the third band, and so they do have a band with music majors. So just by having smaller ensembles with flexible instrumentation, we can populate the so-called third and fourth band with music majors. And having said that, we still have all the directors do, like Wind Symphony, which is an all major band. And also the grad students. So it's similar, but a little bit different, just in the sense that we have smaller ensembles. And so we can have more ensembles with music majors.
Certainly.
Yeah. And with that too, just so that I'm also clear with mine, like neither of the symphony band or the concert band ever use like all our students on every piece.
Got it.
So we'll have a piece of chamber, you know, we'll do something. I might do a harmony music type of piece or another smaller chamber piece on that concert as well as a large piece. So we generally have a lot of flexibility and a lot of rotation on parts throughout every concert.
Yeah.
But we're never using all those students at the same time.
Got it.
And the other thing that we do at Georgia, it's a careful what you wish for situation, but it's a rotation system between the orchestra and the wind ensemble. So the top two large ensembles, large instrumental ensembles, are on rotation. Is that the same at Michigan, Courtney? Did you say that?
It is not the same at Michigan, actually.
Oh, okay.
So we change throughout the semester. Like we change one semester to the next semester.
Yeah.
And that ensemble stays.
There's pluses and minuses to both systems, and it, and we're still experimenting, but we sort of change by sort of. I mean, obviously the saxophones stay the same, euphoniums per concert, and it really depends on. I mean, the downside, of course, is that you don't have a solidified section. You know,
right?
Mark Shadell complains is a strong word, but he does sort of say it's difficult to sort of have a wind section that changes every concert. But having said that, the students get this incredibly diverse experience. You know, they're an orchestra run rotation, then they come to wind ensemble, and, you know, it's for instance, it can be helpful on brass players who just play a lot more in wind ensemble repertoire, generally
right.
speaking.
Right.
Percussionists as well. And so it's when we have auditions, which are happening now, they're not placed in the top orchestra or the top band. They're placed in the rotation. And then the studio teachers and the two conductors work on that rotation system based on the repertoire.
Yeah, that's how it was when I was at Arizona State as a doctoral student with Gary. They do this similar model of rotations, and it can be careful what you wish for. Like you said, on any given concert, it's different.
Yeah, and I feel like it's probably, and I say probably because I'm not exactly sure, there's a lot of pieces that need to be put in place, but it's probably the healthiest, pedagogically for the student, and also the relationship between the orchestra person and the band person, right?
Certainly.
You're not sort of, it's just a kind of a healthy, we're all in this together environment.
Certainly.
And there's no,
I agree
nobody
that
saying,
pedagogically, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and there's nobody saying, well, I don't want to play in orchestra or I don't want to play in band. It's just, this is how it is.
Right.
These
are the experiences that we feel you need to have while you're a student at the University of Georgia or wherever.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of pieces have to be in place, including scheduling, right? So I don't know, this might be off topic, but we deal with a performing arts center where we do our concerts that is under the guise of the provost and does not belong, quote unquote, to the School of Music.
Oh, right.
So we're at the mercy of their programming. So if the orchestra and the wind ensemble aren't programmed back to back, we have issues with the rotation system.
Oh, right.
And this is something that, we're slowly working out, but it can be problematic.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, that's the scheduling issue is probably one of the main reasons why it's challenging for us to be able to accommodate that. I would say that that's not to say that there aren't many people at Michigan that would actually like to do the rotation system. It's just, as of now, we haven't been able to find a solution to work out the scheduling component
yeah.
and the challenges that come forth from that.
In the perfect world where we all have giant halls.
Sorry?
I would say in the perfect world where we all have giant performance halls that belong to us and only you, I guess
right.
that's only the real solution.
Well, one of the things that we're thinking of doing next year, because scheduling has been tricky, is I'm thinking, for instance, this past fall, there were almost a week and a half where the rotation, the people that were in wind ensemble, we had done our concert, but the orchestra concert wasn't until 2 weeks later, a week and a half later. And so, what are we going to do? And we devised sort of a sight reading extravaganza, which was really fun. It turned out to be really fun. We sight read difficult works, new works, and of course the grad students had a lot of time in front of the wind ensemble. We sight read some less difficult works, and we had some music ed students get in front of the ensemble. And the feedback on that was really positive. So there are things that you can do if you have scheduling issues. The other thing I was thinking of doing next year is a longer rotation where we actually memorize a whole concert and we don't have any music stands on the stage. For every challenge, there's sometimes a creative solution, but we still have scheduling issues with the Performing Arts Center coming up, so I am thinking of things that we can do that sort of are outside of the box, per se,
sure.
But are still pedagogically interesting and fun and might actually be more interesting than just putting on another concert the same old way.
Certainly. Certainly. Well, that's actually a great segue, speaking of. The next question I have posed is how do you approach programming and conducting music outside of what we may call the canon? And I guess for many of our listeners, they may not know exactly what the wind ensemble canon is. Our first episode is sort of devoted to that idea, so I'm going to assume that they have a little bit of background. But for you, at both of your schools, it sounds like we have different ensembles to discuss here. How do you each approach programming and conducting music that may not necessarily be canonic to your students?
I mean, I'm very deliberate about programming contemporary or newer music.
Sure.
And sometimes it might be a piece that's performed in the recent past. But certainly I'm always, I can't even tell you how many hours I would spend kind of combing through composers' websites, just trying to be deliberate about, oh, I really like this piece, or I've heard this piece that another ensemble performed it, or I saw that it was listed in their programming and something that they published. I spend probably the better part of April and May, or maybe end of April into May, that's what I'm doing, is spending all my time figuring out programming. And I have been, in the time that I've been here, especially starting in my second year and beyond, I've been much more deliberate about making sure that I'm programming pieces by women and minority composers. And initially it started with just wanting to program a piece, at least a piece by a woman on every concert. And then it kind of morphed into, okay, now I want to have more representation of minority composers, and then kind of both. And I've shifted with how I go about kind of deciding how I'm going to program for the year, to kind of try out new things. It gives me, I just have different goals in mind.
Sure.
But by doing that, it's really pushing out of the canon, because there's just not as much repertoire that's had the test of time, because we just don't have the history of women and minority composers.
Right.
That mm-hmm. we do for the white male composers. So that certainly pushes outside of the quote-unquote canon. Certainly we spend a fair amount of money wanting to commission pieces, whether it's specifically commissioning something directly from my ensemble or from Mike's ensemble as a symphony band, or it's being part of a consortium. And also being deliberate about those pieces fulfilling something new in the canon versus kind of repeat, you know, pressing repeat. Those have been very deliberate choices.
Yeah.
So that's how, I mean, I can say that I might spend a whole 8 hours a day for like a week trying to finish my program, but it gets really hard to finish the last few minutes of each program.
Right.
Especially
right
when you have certain goals in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. Yeah. I'm not sure there's any one of us that aren't, would not be nodding our head as Courtney's speaking here. I mean, we spend an incredible amount of time trying to work this out, and there's just so many variables that matter. One thing I would add is, there are two things I would add to what Courtney has said, and that is, I think it's important in the course of the time that the students are with me that they play what we have deemed as the quote-unquote core repertoire, or at least enough of that I feel satisfied that they understand where we have come from and kind of the evolution to where we started, from Gabrielli to where we're
right.
where we're going. And then, now I forget the other thing I wanted to add, but... in addition to that, I would say that that's where I feel it's my responsibility to give the graduate students those opportunities to conduct that repertoire.
Sure.
So it's important for me. I mean, I've done it, and I'm there in the room, but I think it's important for the graduate students to do it with an excellent ensemble so that they can really understand that score. Do it with a quality group and massage it in a way that gives meaning for them as well. And I just thought of the other thing. Because I, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is how much time I spend on this, and we spend on this, and actually this creates more work, but I think it's important. I have increasingly asked the students in the ensemble to suggest repertoire. So that, you know, the students in my ensemble are doctoral master students in performance or music ed students. So they know a repertoire. They've played it in other high quality groups, or they're learning it in their music education classrooms. And, you know, I'll give them sort of an outline of a program. Here's where I'm going with this. Here's where we are with the key centers. Here we are with a theme. Here we are with, the artistic sense of this. Here are three pieces that I think would fit with it. What do you think? you know, or do any of you have any suggestions? And that actually has been really, I've learned about pieces that way from students, for instance, which is great. I've learned how students think about things that might be different than the way I'm thinking about it. And the buy-in to that piece or those pieces is higher because they chose it. So that's also been fun.
Wow. That's awesome. Courtney, I think it was you that mentioned just a little while ago, you know, the not disparity, but the certainly there's fewer music, less music rather, written by female composers than that's considered canonic as opposed to, you know, males. And so I'm wondering, are there some pieces that you've performed recently or even music that's on your radar that by female composers that you're really excited about? I know you talked about spending tons of time. I wonder if our listeners might be interested to know some of the wonderful gems you've found.
Oh gosh, there's a lot. This past year, we just did Jennifer Jolly's The Eyes of the World Are Upon You.
Oh yeah.
Which has it related to what Cindy mentioned, a sort of socially conscious connection to it related to gun violence.
Right.
It actually, I'll say that when we started rehearsing that was just after the shooting that happened in Pittsburgh. Like, it literally was like 2 days later when we started rehearsing that. And we actually, within the ensemble, just had a discussion and kind of talk about what was the purpose of us performing this piece and what would the rehearsal process be like, and kind of talked about it once we got to know the piece better, to have a little bit more connection to obviously things that we're experiencing now, even though that's related to a shooting that happened a long time ago at University of Texas. Clearly, it's still something that is we're contemporarily dealing with. There are other pieces. I think one piece that I found that I really am looking forward to doing again is called Double Play by Cindy McTee. And it's a take, especially the first movement has this connection to The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives, and she kind of does it in this inverted reverse fashion. It's really quite fascinating, and it really utilizes like harp and vibes and a saxophone in a way that I think is unique, and the way that they're especially combined together, because that's not typical, those voices being combined together, that I just really fell in love with that piece. And, you know, even when I was deciding to program this, I actually had not realized that Cindy McTee had moved to Southeast Michigan.
Oh, wow.
Because I always knew her from being at University of North Texas. So,
certainly.
She's actually married to Leonard Slatkin now, and he's the director, you know, the conductor of the Detroit Orchestra. And so it was fascinating, because I was like, oh, my gosh, she's right here. So it was amazing, because we could bring her quite easily to see our rehearsal and kind of talk to us about that piece. And I've done other pieces by hers as well, but that one really sticks out to me, because I just really... love that in particular first movement as well. I certainly other composers that might be a little bit beyond what my group can do on a that I can just generally program for. So anything by Sofia Gubadalina. I think Susan Boddy is really quite amazing. There's some really great pieces that utilize voice and choir that I think are just really quite fascinating. There's a
Cosmosis.
Lot more, but those are the ones that came to my mind as I was thinking about this.
Sure. Cynthia, I know you conduct a variety of ensembles. I know you both conduct the contemporary ensemble at Georgia, and then, of course, with your ensemble with the top group. Can you talk a little about any pieces that are on your radar or any composers that you've done recently that our listeners should know about?
Yeah, when you talk about gems, I mean, a few pieces come to mind. I just did Shout Out by Roshan Adada.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I just think is fantastic, and I actually did it with New York Allstate, and I programmed. I didn't mean to do this, but it evolved this way, which was really wonderful. But we opened with Shout Out, which is a gem, I think, and then we did Omar Thomas's Of Our New Day Begun,
sure.
which is an incredible piece, and ended with Maslanka's Give Us Our Day, and the meaning of Shout Out evolved during the concert. This is the feedback that we got from audience members and students, and that Shout Out, instead of just being a little shout out piece, which it can be, became almost a protest. against racism and gun violence because of the way that it was programmed. And I'd love to take credit for that, except that I didn't think of that. It just evolved as it just kind of evolved that way. But I think that that's a gem. Catherine Lakuta, who's a Ukrainian composer mm-hmm. living in Australia, wrote a piece called Diary of a Madman that's it is a modern day oratorio with a secular theme, and the theme is mental illness. And that is a phenomenal piece that the students and the audience had visceral reactions to. I mean, this is a very important piece.
Wow.
Sally McCoon wrote a piece called High Water Rising for us. The day after the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Treaty, which is a piece directly, musically speaking, about climate change, which, again, the students really enjoyed working on. I've done that now with a couple of ensembles, and they also have a strong reaction to it. There's another piece that when I do High Water Rising again, I'd like to pair it with Ruth Gipp's piece called Seascape, which is for chamber ensemble, which I think would be kind of a lovely pairing. Ruth Gipp's is a British composer, not contemporary, but a phenomenal composer. Katie Abbott, Australian composer, wrote a piece called Punch, which is fantastic for brass and percussion. I agree, Cindy McKee's double play is fantastic. We paired that with the Charles Ives. We opened with the Charles Ives and then did Cindy McKee, which is a kind of a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Kristen Custer, of course, has written some real gems. I mean, I could go on. Melinda Wagner's Stamp is great. All of Joan Tower's Fanfare for the Uncommon Woman are difficult, but phenomenal.
Yeah.
Thea Musgrave, Journey Through a Japanese Landscape, I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
I could go on there, but
that piece just was recommended to me earlier in the fall, and I recognize the name, but I didn't know the piece, and yeah, wow.
Which one?
The Thea Musgrave piece that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
Typing, listing out pieces right here too, so I can link them all on our podcast. I had no idea.
Yeah. The other one that we just did, by Shi Wong, called Winter Blossom is a piece that she wrote for our mutual friend, Steve Stuckey, who died, in 2016. It was 2015, I guess. And, that piece is, I happened to have two music therapy students in the ensemble when we were preparing that to program the premiere, and they talked about how this is actually the five stages of grief. And when Shi Wong came and she talked to the audience about that, she said she actually didn't realize she was writing that out. This is also an incredible piece of music. Wow. Winter Blossom, it's called.
That's what I was just going to ask one more time.
I was actually going to bring that one up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because I knew you just premiered it. And it's funny that we talk about overlap, because I did Roshan's shout out last year as well. Mm-hmm. And I just did Salim Kuhn's High Water Rising. And I love, as I was listening back actually to the recording that we did, and we were able to get Sally to come out, which was great as well. It's such a stunningly beautiful piece, and the way that she melds these kind of colors together, and the unusual kind of nature of the way that the melody lies together, I think is really quite stunning.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Sally's special.
I'm looking forward to linking all these into the audience. I think they'll be really interested to hear some of this stuff. We'll do my best to include as many as possible. Well, with all of this new music and programming it with your ensembles, whether that be your own ensemble or Cynthia, you mentioned with the all-state groups, what's your impression of students in these performing ensembles when they perform this newer repertoire, this sort of non-canonic repertoire? Do they seem to think it's innovative, or what's your feedback from some of this?
Mixed. To be honest.
Yeah.
I think that you develop a taste for innovation. Maybe a controversial statement, but but I think it's, I think that's been my experience. And I think that we sometimes, by we, I'm going to say the general wind band conductors and orchestra conductors, I think we sometimes forget that we have to teach this music. I mean, we can't just put it in front of our students and say, this is, I think this is quality music, and therefore you need to buy in and prepare it like you would prepare a whole suite.
Right.
We have to do a better job, generally speaking, of teaching what makes quality quality. We're very good at criticizing bad music, right? Oh, it's too repetitive, or it's banal, or it's pedagogical, or, you know, it's a silly title, or whatever, you know. We're really good at that, but we're not necessarily terrific at defining for ourselves what makes good music good, and then therefore we're not very good, generally speaking, at teaching that in our ensembles. We somehow just simply kind of think that they're going to learn it by osmosis, or just because we put what we think is quality music in front of them, therefore they're going to agree. And I think that that's doing them and ourselves and our audiences and the music a disservice. So when we put this new music in front of them, we have to be prepared to point out what makes it quality and why we have why we love it.
Yeah.
I think we have to teach our audiences that too. I think we sell our audiences short. We're scared to program a lot of new music for our audiences, and I think that we're more afraid than they are. But I do think that we have to think about how we guide them through it, our students and our audiences.
Certainly. Courtney, I'm wondering...
I do think that that's really quite important as well.
I would agree with Cindy about the
results in terms of how the students view it. I think I'll have students come to me and say, oh, I really loved such and such piece, or another person's like, oh, I don't really like that piece at all. But I think that's kind of the nature of who we are.
Right.
I still hope that no matter what, whether they quote unquote like the piece or not, that there's still something within the piece that they can draw to and recognize that they could learn something from that, whether it's simply learning how to do something different on their instrument as their performance majors, or you know, trying to get better playing. Hopefully it's stoking something that kind of lights up their brains and recognizes, yeah, I am learning something through this process, irrespective of whether I like the piece or not.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Do you find, Courtney, I know that you work with the Michigan Youth Wind Band as well. Do you find that the younger students, the high school students, tend to palette a little bit more of new music than the old, or is it an equal experience for both those and your college students?
It's different. You know, with the youth symphonic band, they're still coming from their high school experiences, so some of them, you know, would be really strong gung-ho musicians that really want to go and major in performance or major in music at college. Others just really like playing in band.
Right.
Or they just really want to have opportunities to play. So I find that I have to stoke a little bit more of what their natural kind of inclinations are about certain things. Like, I know that, for example, it's going to sound a certain way. They're going to be able to buy into it quicker than they would something else. So I don't think I could be quite as pushing the boundaries with them, whom I've rehearsed with 8 times before we do a concert. So, you know, we rehearse Sundays. We get 8 rehearsals, and then we do our dress in concert.
Sure.
I have to make sure, okay, the buy-in, I think, for them has to be a little bit more easily noticed. Not completely, but I just feel like that's something that they have to be able to buy into, because it just, like, if it has the right amount of notes, it feels like it's idiomatic under the fingers, like, they're going to want to play it, and it's going to feel good to play it.
Right.
And they can kind of grab onto that and gravitate towards that. And if I can balance that out with some other elements, then that's kind of how I go about it. I still am deliberate about making sure to program variety, whether it's something in the canon that they probably can't do with their high school band.
Right.
Or it's something of being deliberate about, okay, let's make sure that they have experience playing something by the minority composer and the woman composer. I'm thinking about those things as well.
Sure.
Because I'm not sure that they're always getting that in their high school experience.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. I conducted a similar group of that makeup in Maine when we were living there, a youth wind ensemble, and Yep, it's the same sort of balance. I totally get that.
I think just to add to that,
sure.
I think in some ways the high school students are a little bit more open to, you know, extended techniques or music that pushes the boundaries of what they think band can do. Just because they, you know, by the time they're master's doctoral students, sometimes they can get a little bit cynical. You know, sometimes we can sort of teach the joy of music making right out of them by the time they're doctoral students, which is a whole other conversation. And I hope I'm not doing that, but we just sort of systemically that can happen. And so sometimes I think high schools are a little bit more, a little more vulnerable or a little more open or a little bit more willing to try new things.
Sure. We talked a lot about repertoire and pieces particular, and each one of you talked about working with a living composer. I'm wondering, for our listeners, are there conductors or soloists that you've worked with recently that people should be more aware of? Maybe, I think we talked quite through composers, but maybe if we missed anyone as well that you think are doing great things or you've had the opportunity to do great things with, and perhaps if they happen to be female or a minority composer, conductor, soloist as well.
Well, you want me to go first?
Sure. That sounds great.
I mean, the first two women that come to mind are Maggie Snyder on viola. She happens to be faculty at the University of Georgia. In fact, both of the women I'm about to mention are. We did a piece called Love Among the Ruins by James Seiler, and she was our soloist, and she's just absolutely the most soulful player I've worked with on that string instrument, on the viola. I mean,
wow.
She's just this gorgeous, fat, warm chocolate sound, but just the way she phrases is absolutely stunning. And the other one is Lisa Stepanova, who played Messiaen with us at CBDNA, and she's just a rock star on the piano. I mean,
wow.
A rock star.
That was quite the performance.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you. I mean, but it was a great performance.
She was fantastic.
She's a superstar.
Wow. Cool.
At my school, typically the people that I'm working with are either an advanced student of sorts, but typically I'm featuring faculty members.
Sure.
On solo performances. So, and I've had opportunity to pretty much work with all the winds and brass faculty at the University of Michigan. But I've also had an opportunity to even work with the jazz faculty, and we did a piece by Alan Vizzuti called Jazzscapes that actually featured a jazz sextet. And one of the most fabulous jazz musicians that I know is Ellen Rowe, and she used to be chair, but she's pianist, and she actually just had an album come out of all women composers and performers in jazz, which has even struggled perhaps more with getting women, you know, gender equity. But that's like a really big passion of hers.
Wow.
So having opportunities to be able to play with people like that are just incredible.
Wow. That's awesome.
You know, and I'm also thinking of Susan Boddy, who B-O-T-T-I, who
right.
We should have mentioned, is mm-hmm. a gem. So she wrote Cosmosis, and she came when we did it at Cornell, she came and worked with us, but also sang. And she's phenomenal. I mean, she's a phenomenal composer, but also a wonderful singer. And then in terms of conductors, I have to mention Jacqueline Hartenberger, who's
right.
the associate director of bands at the University of Georgia, who's just also a rock star. You know, a really phenomenal musician and a beautiful colleague.
That's awesome. It's really great. I'm going to jump and we'll come back to the next one. We've talked a lot about repertoire and different, especially new repertoire. And one of the questions that I keep thinking about is how do we shift the canon towards repertoire that looks more diverse than it currently does without denying the performance of masterworks? Sort of instead of like super shifting the canon and we forget to play some of these things. I think, Cynthia, you mentioned some of the works that we've commissioned in the last 20 or 30 years don't get a second, third, or fourth performance. Maybe you could
Right.
talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that, you know, 30, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, when we as an ensemble world started commissioning great living composers, we really needed to do that. And we still need to do that, don't get me wrong. But we aren't doing a very good job of reprogramming those pieces. I'm guilty of this as well. I've actually backed off the commissioning side of things. I used to just sign up for everything, and now I'm just being a little bit more thoughtful about that and spending more time looking at the things that we've commissioned over the years that I think need to become part of the core repertoire.
Sure.
I also think that we need to do a better. I mean, this is going to be controversial, but I think we need to stop. I hesitate saying this, but I think we need to stop composing or stop programming Black composers during Black History Month.
Yep.
There you go. I said
we talked about this yesterday with Andrea and Amy.
We need to stop doing that. I mean, I get why we're doing that. It's just that seems to be the only time when
right.
we do
right.
it.
Right. It needs to be just a more normal part of every concert.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. And I listened to an interview with Morgan Freeman where he talked about Black History Month and we should just get rid of it. And I remember a few years ago when I heard that, just sort of going, gosh, I just did not think of it that way. And nor probably did the organizers of Black History Month when they
Certainly.
Put it together, or Women's History Month or whatever. I now sort of get where he was coming from, that instead of that and all of the good things that it does, it's our responsibility now as people in a positions that we're in to just make it part of the mainstream. We just have to do it.
Sure.
I think that's kind of along the same lines of not just programming women on an all-women concert.
Yeah.
Not to say that you couldn't just do an all-women concert. There's value to that. But I think that we just need to be deliberate about making sure that this just comes up on our radar with our programming in general.
Yeah.
Right.
Certainly. I talked to one of the first people I spoke to is Caroline Hand at Ball State, and she said that she has a goal in mind to try and program a female composer on every concert, but it doesn't always happen because sometimes, and as you were talking about earlier too, Courtney, that sometimes it's difficult to program those last few minutes of a concert and figure that out. So sometimes it doesn't happen, but being mindful mm-hmm. of it and saying, you know what, I'm going to try and do this as opposed to just the all-female concert once a year, check the box, move on to program the rest of the repertoire as you see fit, you know, isn't really a solution.
Right.
I'm wondering if you could look into the future. I think, Cynthia, you mentioned if you dropped someone from, you know, the 1920s in the middle of Times Square, they'd be shocked at what they saw, but not in the classroom. What do you imagine if you could be that time traveler forward in 20 or 30 years? What do you think our profession looks like, or especially with a lot of the, you know, changes in repertoire, things like that, that you might be seeing evolve currently?
I think this is just my little, you know, my little soapbox for a second, but I would think that rehearsals look a lot different. I've been projecting the score for the last 6, 7, 8 years now, and it's completely changed how I rehearse. It's more efficient, but it's also more engaging. And I would hope that more and more people, the fact that there's only one person in the room that has all the information at any given time, just completely crazy. It just speaks to an older, more top-down way of doing things that I think is completely and rightfully gone by the wayside. So I would hope that our rehearsals look a little or a lot different. In terms of our repertoire, and we keep saying this, and I used to not believe it, but now I do. It is slowly changing, and I think that it's really an exciting time. Courtney, I don't know if you agree with me, but I just feel like there's more and more
activism in the direction of underrepresented composers and people who are committed to doing the right thing for the right reasons. And so I do not think that it is a trend like high-waisted jeans. I think that it's something that's going to, you know, literally change what we do and how we do it. So it's very exciting to be kind of in this time as we're sort of before our very eyes, we're seeing people who are making websites like Jody Blackshaw is about to launch this website called Colorful, F-U-L-L, that makes people sort of commit to doing this. Christian Folk has been part of the composer diversity thing, along with Rob Deemer. Courtney, you're part of something called, what is it? We Are
and
Here.
We Were Heard.
Yeah. And We Were Heard.
And We Were Heard.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just very exciting because people are doing the work that, and frankly, it's because a lot of us are in the position that we can be heard. Let's face it, 25 years ago, the majority of people in DOB jobs or ADOB jobs were white men. Nothing against white men. Mm-hmm. I'm married to one, but, you know, we're paying attention, as are white men, you know, paying attention to this. They see this as a good thing and not a threat. I mean, the fact that John Mackey for the past 2 years has given over his booth at Midwest for this very thing is extraordinarily wonderful.
Yeah.
Yay, John Mackey.
Well, we're definitely at a tipping point kind of place. And I would 100% agree with you, Cindy, in that sense, because this is definitely not just a trend. I think some people still haven't quite bought into that, but over time, once it reaches that tipping point, you can't really go back, and that's great.
Right.
People are recognizing the biases that have existed for a long time and chipping away at the concept of sexism and racism. It's like we knew they existed, but it's kind of that iceberg. You see the stuff on top, and you have this kind of cultural awareness level right at the sea level, but then you realize all the stuff that's actually underneath that iceberg is all still part of that.
Right.
And I think as we reach this tipping point, we're just recognizing how much more there is underneath the surface of the water. And that's kind of like that eye-opening experience. I mean, even myself, I'm like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And right. I think as more of that's happening, it's a sort of just cultural awareness. It spreads. So in some ways it's like culture is very slow to change, but when you're at a point where it's a tipping point, it feels phenomenally fast.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. It's just that kind of initial tipping over feels kind of fast. Now, still, there's work to be done. But it feels right now that we're just at that point where it's, like, really going to start to tip over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is a pretty cool place to be.
Yes, yeah. Certainly.
Yeah. I mean, I have a funny story about this that kind of demonstrates how change happens and how it doesn't. I mean, 2 years ago, I think it was in the summer, Music for All did a thing on women band directors, Andrea Brown and I, and the woman from United Sound, which is a whole other part of this conversation too, right? People with disabilities, did a thing on women as band director, which I, you know, 10 years ago would say, you know, I would run completely in the other direction, but now, of course, I've not only experienced it, but I have tenure and I can say these things that I've believed all my life. And you know, in a lot of ways, it should be the white men that are championing this, but so be it. But we did a full thing on women as band director, and it was a very powerful. And Courtney, we did that thing at Midwest that turned out to be mm-hmm. extremely powerful for the people in the room. But, you know, we ended up with a series of recommendations for Music for All on how to tip the point. And one of them was having ensembles that come to Music for All, requiring them to perform a piece by an underrepresented composer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we did all of this work and put together this proposal, and Music for All is like, yeah, this is really great. And And this is, I don't mean to sort of diss Music for All because they are committed to doing this, but a couple of thoughts, flash forward a couple of years and I get a list of repertoire of over 800 pieces of music that Music for All is going to put on their This Is Quality Band repertoire.
Okay.
Guess how many female composers were on that list?
Zero.
Out of actually, it was close to 900.
Oh, wow.
Guess how many female composers?
Three?
Go ahead. I would hate to say zero.
No, there was more
five?
Than zero. There were four.
Wow.
Out of close to 900. How many black composers? One.
Yeah.
And so I just went crazy. Like, and I sent an email that said 2 years ago I did this and, you know, blah, 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 and what's going on? Blah, 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 blah. You know, I just went on a rant about it. And, you know, a lot of backpedaling happening. You're absolutely right. Oh, my goodness, left-hand, right-hand problem. Can you suggest some works? Yes, I can. You know, blah, blah, blah. And then somebody who shall remain nameless chimed in to say, while I think that this is an honorable thing, we have to focus on quality. And yeah, it was just sort of that, oh my God. It was just one of those moments of complete frustration.
I can imagine.
With this person not getting it. Not getting it in the first place, realizing the mistake and going, ah, yeah, you're absolutely right, so sorry. And fixing the problem, and then somebody else chiming in and taking us back 10 steps.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it is, right? I mean, this is just sort of back and forth with, you know, we're going to get there, and it seems really slow, and there are really frustrating moments, but I absolutely agree with Courtney that we're at the tipping point, and it's going to move fast.
Yeah.
Well, and if I can do a little promo here, but part of the reason why, like what Cindy just mentioned, you know, these discussions have happened before about somebody having good intentions to try to program something by, you know, have more diverse representation in their composers that they're, you know, playing. And then somebody says, well, I just program quality repertoire. And if it happens to be, and it's, but that's part of the reason why we're doing this whole "and we were heard," because when it comes down to publishing and what's getting promoted, it's still very dominated by the white male composer. So by trying to get more recordings, more kind of publicity to these more underrepresented composers, we're hoping to also create, it's going to take longer, but to create that sort of tipping point. Well, let's get this more obvious so that people can find it easier and get it promoted more, because then they're more likely to do it.
Right.
If we've been spending so many decades promoting the same music and it's been dominated by white men, well, then that's the music that's going to get promoted. So we have to do something different to get this other music more visible.
Yeah. Well, that's the nail on the head right there. I was going to just ask, and I was hoping that you would bring that up. What type of projects are you working on, either one of you, that may be looking to curve the canon, sort of make help us make these changes over time, and whether they're fast or slow? And I knew that was on your radar, so I'm really excited. The initial launch was really great. It seems to be getting a ton of buzz already.
Mm-hmm.
Courtney, I'm looking forward to. I mean, and I love the. Not only there's promotion of like it of itself, but there's also promotion of other people's stuff having the same conversation. It's not happening in a vacuum. It's look what this, there's a reference to Jody Blackshaw's website. There's the Composer Diversity Project. There's highlighting certain composers and ensembles. I think it's just really an interesting eclectic mix of a lot of things in one place.
Well, and I think that's what's also really important as we're getting to this point where we're reaching this tipping point, that we need to let go of this need to compete with one another and recognize that community can celebrate all the things that we're doing instead of being jealous and angsty about each other. Well, why are you getting to do that, et cetera? It's recognize the accomplishments that we all have strengths and we all have things that we do well and things that we don't do well. And this is why we should be dividing up the responsibilities amongst us all, so that those of us who are strong on something can actually achieve that and promote that. I think that that's kind of lessening down this need to, again, feel kind of bad about myself because somebody else is doing something great.
Certainly.
And just recognizing that, wow, we're all contributing to this.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that, you know, women can be hard on each other. We can be hard on ourselves, and we can be even harder with each other. And you mentioned jealousy and all that sort of stuff. And I actually see that changing as well. I'm not sure because I admit I used to be that way. I early on in my career, it would be like, wait a second. There's only this many women in the profession. So we have to be really competitive.
Right.
You know,
and,
mm-hmm. It's hard not to be.
Yeah. Black people have talked, black people in business. I've read some fascinating interviews about them feeling the same way because most people think of diversity in terms of bean counting, it sets up this highly competitive, this culture, which is really sad. And I actually see that changing as well. It changed in me a few years ago, and it's completely liberating and wonderful and just feels better. But I'm also seeing it in other women and other people and in other things and in literature and even on television shows. Like, it's just,
sure.
It's something that is changing, and I think is really wonderful.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really great. Well, I can't thank you both enough for all of your time and your thoughts and all of this. And the music, I'm so thrilled to be able to link in as many of these tracks in the actual podcast itself, and certainly to link them on the website. I've been trying to make a SoundCloud playlist of many of these performances so people can find them, so they can, you know, just go out and seek out great music, not just because mm-hmm. it feels a niche on their concert, but because why not listen to other things that are outside of your normal canonic band experience, I guess.
Cool.
I was just going to leave the last question with everybody. Is there anything that you'd like to offer on this topic, or any of the things we've talked about today that we didn't get a chance to finish, or that you might feel we skipped through and you wanted to double back to?
You know, there was one thing that I was actually going to say, which is going back to the whole profession in 20 years.
Oh, sure. Yes.
I think in relationship to repertoire and rehearsal, and I was thinking about what Cindy said, it's just so, it is really true about having access to that score makes a huge difference. And, you know, choirs get to do that because predominantly they have the whole score in front of them. But it's a little bit logistically challenging to do that when you have so many notes on a page and you can't move pages with your fingers because they're used for an instrument. But finding a way to have access to that, I think, is important. One of the things that I've done is, and I've learned this actually, you mentioned from Caroline Hand, I saw her do a presentation with Scott Jones at CBDNA last year about kind of having more Orpheus-style rehearsals.
Oh, sure.
Where there's no conductor involved. And I did that for the first time this year, and that was really amazing. And mm-hmm. some who might not have necessarily bought into it first are kind of confused. When they got to the performance and they recognized that this whole process was done by the students in that group from the very beginning to the end, and they all had scores and they all did the score study and whatnot, it was just a really profound experience and something that I'm looking forward to growing. But I also think about, you know, one of the things that I hope will also be maybe part of the repertoire in the future is in soloistic music, they really push the boundaries with what instruments can do and extended techniques. And I think they're a little bit more conservative in the ensemble repertoire, understandably so, especially if you're thinking about marketing and what people can play.
Sure.
But I hope to see that developed more because I think there's a lot of really unique sounds that can come out if we can push the boundaries within the ensemble experience to also incorporate more of these extended techniques and more of these unusual sounds.
Yeah.
I think that could create some really neat quality repertoire.
Yeah, I actually Cynthia, to use your term, to get off the box, I heard you talk about that in a podcast. Was it All Things Band, maybe? Or conduct? Maybe it was The Conductors and Cars. I never remember the name of these two things, but I try to listen to random band-associated things, you know, whether I'm on a run or something like that. And I heard you talk about that, getting off the box and allowing students to have, you know, more sort of a buy-in, you know, getting them to listen bigger. And holy cow, I mean, like you said, Courtney, it changed everything. It completely changed their buy-in. And the need for them to they asked way more questions at the end of that rehearsal about what does so-and-so have going on right here? And because they were listening. They weren't just watching. And we used it a lot this semester, especially my first semester here. And yeah, I totally stole that from you. And I told them that. So Full disclosure.
Cool thing about it too is that I could see some people listening to this and going, "Well, what do we need a conductor for?" But in fact, that's good leadership, isn't it? Is when the followers say we did it ourselves. So I don't think that we're sort of teaching ourselves out of a job. I think quite the opposite, right? We need people to sort of facilitate this process, and that's where I think things are changing too. And maybe another time we could talk about how we teach conducting and what it means in the future to be a conductor. And I think we need to think more this way, that it's not necessarily all about, I mean, yes, gesture and understanding your body and communicating the music and all that sort of stuff, but what does it mean to teach the music and getting off the box and facilitating discussion and asking more questions and all that sort of stuff. The other thing I would add too is that that I didn't mention earlier was the involvement of electronics. I mean, more and more music is involving. You know, Courtney was talking about cool sounds that we can get acoustically with instruments, and you know, I think Karel Husa was one of the first that did some unusual extended techniques, mm-hmm. piccolos and trombones and all that sort of stuff, which is fantastic. But and not just acoustically, but I think that the involvement of electronics and what electronics can do to enhance acoustic music, I think is becoming, I mean, it's always been fascinating, but I think more and more it's becoming really interesting. We're going to program a piece in April called, I can't remember what it's called. It's by Ben Robichaud, which is a three-movement work with an exploration of what happens to your brain when you die. That's for wind ensemble and electronics. That's absolutely creepy cool.
Like, wow.
really, really, really interesting. So I think that, you know, we actually had it programmed with John Mackey's Places You Can No Longer Go, but decided that that's way too heavy for the online. It's too much.
That would be a very heavy.
You surround the rest. You'd have to surround, like, take an intermission and play 27 Sousa marches with pictures from
from
Disney.
Well, then you can do it with Lacuna's oratorio.
Make sure you have therapists in the audience.
What an intermission with couches everywhere. Lie down and tell me your feelings. Wow.
Exactly. And here's some red wine to help you through this concert.
There you go.
What's the date of that? I'm coming.
Right on.
Oh, great. Well, this is such a wonderful conversation, and I'm so grateful for both of your time. I know it's a busy time of year as we wrap things up, and I'm sure we could all continue this conversation up until the minute where we board planes to head to Chicago, but I do appreciate your time, and I'll look forward to seeing you next week, I'm sure. And thanks again for donating your time for this. I'm really looking forward to getting the rest of this put together and sharing it with you.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Thank you, Trey.
It's wonderful, and thank you for the invitation. It's always wonderful to talk with Courtney as well.
Oh, great. Well,
likewise.
Thank you both. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay,
thanks again. Bye-bye.